Welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the endarkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyondananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Uprising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hello there, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed the light on the undarkened corridors of power, and we shine a light ahead of us to where evolution may be leading. The purpose of Wiki Politiki is to bring left and right front and center to face the music and dance together. In other words, to address problems instead of just defending positions. We have another purpose, too, and that is to provide a context at a time when content can be contradictory, confusing, and overwhelming. Speaking of which, Tom Paine would have called these soul-trying times, and anyone with soul would have called these painful times. We have a president who's a bold-faced liar and a mainstream press that prefers lying by omission and nuance. What a choice. Covert skullduggery or overt scumbaggery. That's our choice. Caught between the devil and the deep blue state. So, how do we navigate these waters when it's hard to tell fake real news from real fake news? Well, we can wonder no more. Our guest this week is political uncommentator and radio personality Peter B. Collins, who is here to disabuse the politically abused and hold the line for sanity and wisdom at a time when both are in short supply. Peter B. grew up in Cincinnati, and while in high school, he and his friends built a closed-circuit campus radio station. He then went to Northwestern University in Chicago, and a few years later, he was hosting the late-night talk show on WLS-FM, which his show rose to number one. He moved to the Bay Area in 1976, as a DJ and talk show host on KOME in San Jose. And then in the late 70s, he was a weekend talk host at KGO in San Francisco, which was, at that time, the market leader. For most of the 1980s, he was the morning personality at KRQR, The Rocker. In 1989, he returned to talk radio at KNBR, where he was the token liberal. We'll have to ask him exactly what he was token. And followed Rush Limbaugh each day. We'll find out more about that. He then followed with an afternoon stint on KSFO before it was sold into right-wing demagoguery. He was a satellite radio pioneer on Sirius Radio 2003 and 4. He hosted the syndicated Peter B. Collins show from 2005 to 2009. Then he was part owner of a progressive radio talk station, KRXA in Monterey, California, which was sold in 2014. Currently, he produces a daily podcast, PBC News and Comment, where he covers issues that mainstream media give blanket coverage to, meaning they cover them up with a blanket to make sure everyone is left in the dark. You've had quite a career in radio. Welcome, Peter B.
Steve, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Good. And of course, everybody's going to love your radio voice. I always have. I want to find out a little bit more about your own history. You've been in radio for more than 40 years. You've seen us devolve from actual journalism to news as entertainment, what Swami would call babblum, weapons of mass distraction to keep us from the real news. So let's look at your own history. How did your own political perspective develop over the years? And did you start out as a quote-unquote progressive, or did that develop over time?
I grew up in a Democratic household. Both my parents were strong members of the Democratic Party. The first election, you know, I was conscious of was Nixon and Kennedy. And in Cincinnati, a Republican machine town, my parents were in a deep minority. And so that was something that I was aware of from an early age, the tension between the parties. And, you know, growing up in a red town as a liberal kid was interesting and challenging. My dentist was a member of the John Birch Society. And as I was there open mouth and he was, you know, digging into my teeth, he'd start to lecture me about the evils of communism.
You were a captive audience.
As I was leaving town, Jerry Springer had just been elected mayor. And that's, you know, when it reached a circus level. So, yeah, my politics really were ingrained from my parents. And then I had a sharp difference because my father was a mainstream Democrat. He was a World War II veteran. And mm-hmm. he bought the package. He supported the Vietnam War. And I remember I went to a peace march in Cincinnati with a group of my high school friends. This would have been when I was maybe a junior. And the next day, there was a picture of this march on the front page of the right-wing rag, the Cincinnati Enquirer. And my mother said, "Peter, you know, you don't want your father to see that." And so I took her advice, and I shredded the paper before my dad got a chance to see it. But to his credit, he one of the things that he required is he had gone to a Jesuit high school, St. Xavier, and I have four brothers. We were all required to go there. And we were also required to participate in the debate team for at least 1 year. And I actually enjoyed it. I think I was on the debate team for 2 or 3 years. We went to the state championship at one point. And it was that where that was the experience where I developed argumentation. And I also learned that there were two sides to a debate, because in that old process, you had to take turns, either defending or opposing whatever the proposition before us was. And so that is something I credit. There was also a guy named Tom Kane. He was my speech teacher in grade school, and he had worked in the 1920s as a director and an actor in radio dramas. And Cincinnati was the home of Crosley Broadcasting, which was a regional power under the sure. old order. And mm-hmm. They did a lot of radio dramas. People who know of George Clooney today, his mom was a star on a local TV show that aired for almost 50 years coming out of Cincinnati. So that was, you know, a great experience for me as a young man. And Tom Kane taught us how to do radio dramas in the fourth grade. And we'd do our own sound effects. We'd play different characters. And it was that theater of the mind that really infected me with the radio virus, Steve.
Wow. What a great story. I love that. You were so fortunate to have a teacher like that.
Oh, indeed. Yeah, I feel very fortunate. And in high school, there was another guy named Tom Delaney, and he ran the high school radio club. And when I got there, it was all dots and dashes. It was ham radio. And we pushed those guys over into the corner, and we got Crosley Broadcasting to donate a suite of studio equipment that had been custom made in the 1920s. We had to go shopping for exotic tubes to get it to fire up. But from there, I learned, Steve, that if you have a radio station and you publish a playlist, the record companies will give you free records. And that made the virus go even deeper, I must say.
Wow, that's really, really interesting. I've always loved radio, too, and I could certainly relate to that. As a kid, my favorite was Gene Shepherd, who we'd listen to in New York at 11 p.m., turned the radio down so our parents didn't hear. And he was a phenomenal storyteller. And there's something about radio, unlike TV, where everything is explicit, where the imagination can flow and you can imagine what somebody looks like. It was a different time. Well, let's talk a little bit about your time. I'm really curious as to how you got your gig on conservative radio so that your show followed Rush Limbaugh. And then what was that like? Do you think you had an impact?
Well, this was in the early 90s before the Clinton Telecommunications Act of 96, which really changed the radio industry for the worse and terminally. And in the early 90s, Rush Limbaugh was just getting started in syndication, and the radio stations felt that they needed to offer balance. And the management of KNBR was then owned by a dish company called Faltzcraff, based in Pennsylvania.
Sure.
They felt that they had an obligation to provide both sides. So they added Rush Limbaugh to the lineup, and they kept me as the liberal who came on after him. And that all evaporated after about 3 years when they decided that the backlash over putting Limbaugh on in liberal San Francisco had subsided. And I annoyed them because I allowed the Teamsters union leader to come on the program to talk about their impending strike against Safeway. And I learned in that process that Safeway was the largest single advertiser on KNBR. And the management didn't appreciate that I had caused problems with their biggest sponsor. Now, I'd gone through all the steps. I'd called Safeway, invited them to participate in the program, to send a statement, a representative, and they declined. And then they lowered the boom on me for saying that I had been unfair to them and hadn't allowed their point of view to be broadcast. It was a trap.
Yep, yep. Exactly. So that was in San Francisco. I mean, Rush, what was your take on Rush Limbaugh? I'm sure that you had a take early on as to, you know, what empowered him, where he was coming from. And, you know, did you see him being as big as he ended up being?
Well, it's interesting because the when they announced that they were adding him to the KNBR lineup, they played a recording of him making fun of Jesse Jackson and homeless people. And I thought, oh, that's a really good start. my first impression, I referred to him as a preacher feature because he doesn't have guests. He just holds forth in a monologue. And he, to the extent that he brings in other voices, they're sound bites from his opponents, and he's able to hammer them without any fear that they could actually pipe up and say, hey, man, you're full of it. So I found that, you know, pretty off-putting, but it wasn't my decision to add him to the lineup. Then after about 4 months, he came to San Francisco and did a week of broadcasts from our studios. And that's where I met Rush, and I got a one-hour interview with him. It was uncomfortable because the management sat in the – they kicked out the call screener and sat in her position to monitor my engagement with L. Rushbo. And we've got a little time here before the break. Here's a quick clip from my interview with Limbaugh.
I look at my show as an entertainment forum for people, and I screen calls to find the best call. You know what the main, in my philosophy, you know what the purpose of a good call is on my show? To make me look good. I will tell you flat out, this show is not about what anybody else but me thinks. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to discover what America thinks because it's impossible. There's no talk show host in the world who can tell you what his community or his neighborhood thinks based on what happens on his show. And so I'm not even laboring under that misconception. Calls are there to make me look good, to bring up interesting things. There's no public service aspect. There's no First Amendment aspect that I care about regarding it. We're not looking for people who agree. We secondly strive for people who disagree.
We'll talk more about that as we continue. I joked on that last comment because, you know, the only reason he lets an opposing view on the air is to trash them. He used to have a black woman who called him from Detroit, and he loved it because she would speak in full Ebonics, and he knew that his white racist audience was just amused to no limit by that.
You know, the most surprising thing I've heard in this regard, last year I interviewed another great audio personality, Phil Proctor, who one of the co-founders of the Fireside Theater. And then when they were celebrating their 25th anniversary, they were flown to New York for this big TV show celebration. And so he gets in the cab. Honestly, it's just 25. So it's probably about 25 years ago, probably around in the mid-90s, let's say. He gets on the in the cab, and who is the cab driver have on but Rush Limbaugh? And at the time, it was when Hillary Clinton had presented her health care bill and so on. And Rush is going on about that. And he says, you know, there was an amazing piece of theater that I heard that has always impacted me. And he went and did the entire Fire Sign Theater Beat the Reaper routine as Phil Proctor is listening in. and of course his conclusion was, you know, if you follow this health care bill and follow Hillary, we'll all be trying to beat the Reaper. But it was very interesting to me that, like maybe you and I cut our teeth on Mad Magazine or National Lampoon or something like that. Mm-hmm. He was influenced. Figure when he was a teenager, he was influenced by the Fire Sign Theater. So I thought that was just a really interesting interesting piece, and makes you wonder whatever happened to him. We're going to take a very short break in a minute or two, and we're going to come back with Peter B. Collins and talk about some of the issues that are facing us today. Steve Behrman, this is WikiPoliticky Radio.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio. IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
Are you done with the daily barrage of negativity? Ready for some positivity? Creations Magazine has been inspiring the soul for over 30 years, delivering thought-provoking and solution-driven articles, essays, and poetry that inspire you to enjoy a vibrant life. Holistic health, personal and spiritual growth, relationships, the environment, and so much more. Read us online or order a subscription, creationsmagazine.com.
911, what is your emergency?
My kid shot himself.
All right, where's the wound, sir?
911, what's your emergency?
Please help. My son shot his brother.
911, what is your emergency?
Okay. 911, please state your emergency.
Every day, 8 kids and teens are unintentionally killed or injured by loaded and unlocked guns.
It wasn't locked.
Learn how to make your home safer at endfamilyfire.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and End Family Fire.
Okay, WikiPoliticky, we're back with our guest Peter B. Collins. A question about your other radio career in, oxymoron alert, progressive radio. I remember Tom Hartman had a show. There was a progressive radio station. I know you were on Sirius. Tell us more about the that stint on progressive radio and what that was like.
Well, there were a couple of phases of it, Steve. There was a fledgling effort to launch liberal talk, by an arm of the United Auto Workers. They formed a radio network based in Detroit called IE America. I never knew what it stood for, IE. It is.
Yeah, exactly.
That's where I first met Tom Hartman, Peter Werby, Mike Malloy. There were a few other people who were on that network. And they picked up my show, which was originating in San Francisco. And then when Sirius came along, we cut a deal where IE America had its programs on Sirius. Now, at that time, there were only about 500 truck drivers across the country who had Sirius satellite radios. But I met a lot of great truck drivers who were extremely well-informed, I'll say that.
Yeah.
So I stayed on Sirius for a couple of years. And then after the 2004 election is when Hal Ginsberg and I bought a radio station in Monterey and flipped it to Liberal Talk. And this occurred at about the same time that Air America was launching its national radio service. So our Monterey station carried some of the Air America shows, but not all. And that's where I launched my syndicated show from. I did the afternoon shift in Monterey, and that was syndicated first to Eureka. And then in the end, we were on in about a dozen markets, and we picked up Boston so we could finally say we were coast to coast. But then the Bush recession of 2008 crashed the radio industry. And that coincided with the implosion of Air America, which was so badly managed. They thought Al Franken was a marquee star. I'm glad he made it to the Senate, off the platform of Air America. And I'm glad that Rachel Maddow was picked up by MSNBC. But beyond that, it was a total failure. They fleeced investors. They didn't pay radio stations money that they promised. And it left just a terrible taste among radio managers who were predisposed to be against liberals to start with. And so at this stage, Air America has helped seal the fate so that talk radio in the United States today is about 95% conservatives. And the other 5% are moderates. There are no, flaming liberals who are permitted daily access to radio stations in this country anymore. Tom Hartman is one exception, but when you look at the lineup of stations he's on now, it pales in comparison to the peak that he enjoyed back around 2007. And so it was really sad to see the opportunity squandered. The other thing I'll say is that the Obama team, the campaign teams in both elections, would not support liberal talk radio. They raised and spent hundreds of millions of dollars, and they focused only on television in 2008, and they added a fairly sophisticated web effort in 2012. But they would not support progressive talk radio, and they wouldn't even put Obama on. You know, we went to the coronation, the Denver convention in 2008, and Fox Radio had the best position in the whole house. All of the liberals were stashed under an escalator in a basement, and they kept feeding us guests who were Hillary supporters. The Obama team didn't care about radio, and they just didn't support it either with dollars or by participating. And making it a vibrant platform. So those are factors that led to the state of play we have today, which is dreadful. And that is you can drive for hours and put your AM radio on seek or scan, and you'll hear a lot of voices, and they're all using the same right-wing talking points every damn day.
Mm-hmm. And those are the people that they've been impacting for the past 25 or 30 years or longer. The Obama idea, I mean, was it that he thought that radio was passé, that the young people that he wanted to reach would not be listening to radio? And then what about FM? What about NPR and so on? What about NPR?
NPR is a long conversation, but let me say that.
And by the way, you can be as blunt as you want to be on this show. We tell people we always do a disclaimer. All opinions are expressed are those of the speaker. So if you don't like the opinions, turn your speaker down.
I was once approached by a headhunter and asked if I wanted to pitch for one of the openings on All Things Considered. And I said, well, I've got two objections. One is, do I have to check my sense of humor at the studio door? And do I have to check my opinions at the revolving door at the street before I even enter NPR? And those are my issues. Now, NPR strives to be a journalistic operation where their hosts do not offer their own personal opinions. I understand that. But it has become a zone where views that are outside of the Beltway mainstream are only presented in order to be ridiculed or marginalized. And right now, NPR is part of the media cabal that is promoting regime change in Venezuela as if it's as obvious, you know, to be the right answer as, you know, tying your shoes. And they're presenting biased coverage. They are not acknowledging that this guy Guaido is a self-promoter who has designated himself the new leader of the country in order to be recognized by the United States. But there's absolutely no basis, pardon me, for a regime change operation in Venezuela. We are not bound by treaties to do so. And when you see people like John Bolton, Mike Pompeo, and they dredged up the fossilized remains of Elliot Abrams. This is a bloodthirsty trio. And when they talk about humanitarian aid, that scene on the border of Colombia on February 23rd was a false flag operation. And the New York Times took 2 weeks to report the truth. But independent reporters like Max Blumenthal at the Gray Zone Project, they reported the next day that it was not Maduro supporters who torched the tractor trailer rig with alleged humanitarian relief in it. It was opponents of Maduro who were trying to stoke a conflict so the U.S. had an excuse to intervene. And now the power is shut down across most of Venezuela, and the corporate media barely even considers the possibility that that was caused by nefarious actors, including the possibility it was U.S. spies. And it's interesting because Max Blumenthal reported today that in 2010, Juan Guaido, the would-be leader of Venezuela, was trained by a U.S.-backed organization on how to create the biggest disturbance in Venezuela in order to produce regime change. And one of the ideas that surfaced there was to sabotage the power grid. But you won't see, pardon me, you won't see any reporting, investigation, or even speculation on that in most American media outlets.
You know, this goes back to what you said, Clinton, 1996. Was that the end of the Fairness Doctrine, or was that something else?
No, the Fairness Doctrine was actually an administrative order that was ended at the FCC during the final years of the Reagan administration.
Mm-hmm.
And it is fair to say that Rush Limbaugh would not be what he is today if we still had a Fairness Doctrine. But I have to say that I chafed when I worked under it. I'll give you this example. In the 1970s, I'm working in Chicago, and Jesse Jackson is a big figure in Chicago, right? And I'm working for a station that's owned by the ABC network. And at the networks, the lawyers are, they've got their fingers in everything. And they're always telling you, oh, don't do this and don't do that. So there is an investigative reporter who publishes a very deep investigation into Jesse Jackson's Operation Push. And fundamentally, what he showed was that he was running a kind of political machine where he would go and approach the Miller Brewing Company and say, you don't have enough black truck drivers or people working in your brewery. And Miller would say, you're right, and so we're going to agree to hire more blacks. Well, the way it was set up, you had to hire people who were selected and approved by Jesse Jackson's brother, Noah. And that was not very different from Boss Daley's political machine in Chicago.
Right.
So I brought this reporter on my show. I invited Jesse Jackson or a spokesperson or a lawyer, and they declined to participate. After the broadcast, I'm called into the manager's office, and there's this lawyer from New York on the phone, and they're saying, Peter, you really screwed up. Jesse Jackson's really pissed at us. And I said, look, I followed the rules. I invited him on, and you're telling me I should have not broadcast the information because he had refused to participate? And they said, yes, you should not have aired that segment. And they ended up paying him $10,000 over my objections to make that problem go away. And Jesse did that a lot.
You and I both know, since we recorded this in your studio, when I did the interview with William Pepper, who was Martin Luther King's attorney, part of what Bill Pepper has said, and he has evidence for it, that Jesse Jackson was one of the people who helped betray Martin Luther King. So, again, because of how people line up with people who they think ought to be allies, a lot of times bad doers kind of slip in under the radar because they're protected. It sounds like even the best law can be used poorly. And in that case, the fairness doctrine became the unfairness doctrine when even though you reached out to some to get him to comment, it didn't work. So I understand what you're saying.
Here's one of the problems, Steve, is that as media have evolved, just a second here. Pardon me, I'm just recovering from a cold and it's settled in my chest a little bit. Cable news, for example, is completely unregulated. The FCC has zero jurisdiction over Fox News. And that's one of the reasons why during the 2016 campaign, you saw most of the presidential debates staged on cable news channels. ABC did one a little later, and I believe CBS hosted one. But, you know, there were many of them, and most of them were done on cable platforms. And the reason is they could give Trump more time. They weren't subject to the equal time provisions of the 1934 Communications Act. And you saw they frequently would exclude people like John Kasich, who'd say, hey, I got my hand up over here. I've got a comment. And they would just go back to Trump, or they'd go to Jeb Bush when he was considered to be the front runner. And that kind of unfairness is built into our system today. And it would take massive re-regulation and rewrites of the old Communications Act in order to cover the channels, and we're not even talking about online programs that are subject to the jurisdiction of nobody.
You know, this is really, as we've devolved, you talked about the evolution of radio, but it's really devolved into just another tool for the oligarchy to continue using. And NPR, I stopped listening to them in 2003, I think it was, when they came out in favor of the Iraq War. To me, they became useless, simply a place where progressives could feel comfortable that somebody is actually using their intellect. And yet, as you pointed out, certain issues cannot be talked about. So that's why I really appreciated your narrative on Venezuela. So let's talk about that a little more. Where can people go to get a clear, clear story about issues like Venezuela? Where do you go?
Well, you know, I am in contact with, and I guess I would be described in some cases as in collusion with, a number of media outlets like ConsortiumNews.com, I mentioned Max Blumenthal and the Gray Zone Project. There's a great reporter in Chicago named Kevin Gostola, who publishes at shadowproof.com. Mm-hmm. There's Truth Out and Truth Dig, which are larger, more established independent media outlets. The Real News Network has some pretty good video reporting. And there are a lot of people who say that if something is on RT or one of the other platforms like Sputnik that are owned by the Russian government, it's very convenient just to say, I don't trust anything that comes from them because that's Russia. But keep in mind, Ed Schultz, who passed away last year,
yes,
he was one of the progressive talk hosts who launched With All of Us back in 2004 and 2005. And he was bounced by MSNBC because he supported Bernie Sanders. They took him off the air.
MSNBC?
Yes.
Wow. Yeah.
Explicitly because he wanted to cover Bernie Sanders. And, you know, certainly the network did allow Sanders on. He did interviews with Rachel Maddow. I'm not saying they totally blacked him out. But when it became clear that Ed was identifying with the working class people who were supporting Sanders, they moved him to the weekends and then they fired him. And he wound up on RT. And I had many issues with Ed Schultz. He and I didn't see eye to eye on everything. But I have real respect for the stand that he took. And when he went to RT, he did great work. There was no indication that any of it was tainted by, a Russian minder or input from Moscow. And Tom Hartman spent 2 years producing an hour-long nightly news program on RT. And I know Tom, and I know that he did not sacrifice any of his principles or accept any limitation on his free expression when he worked at RT. So like any outlet, you have to pick and choose. There's some good reporters. There's some bad reporters. There's some honest reports that come out of a certain outlet, and there's some dishonest reports. And as media consumers, we have to be strong enough in our own confidence to be able to determine what is credible and what is not.
We'll be back after this very short break. Have a little bit more of a conversation with Peter B. Collins on real news, fake news. This is Steve Behrman, Wiki Politiki. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a few.
Free your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
Hello, I'm Lisa Barry. Join me every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for Light on Living, a chance to see new, hear different, and feel more as I shine the spotlight on all the ways to lighten the load of life's challenges. Light on Living is your link to that new way you're looking for, that new understanding that will enhance your life, and that positive connection that will support your growth. So join me, and you'll gain insight and start to see things in a new way that motivates you.
The Shift Network, presenting transformative programs and events to help you awaken to your full potential so that together we can build the more beautiful world our hearts know is possible. Our classes support you in finding and cultivating your gifts and in bringing those gifts to the world to create tangible change and connect us as global citizens. Go to theshiftnetwork.com or follow the link on the Wiki Politiki sponsors page.
Imagine being fired because of who you love. Imagine being denied medical treatment because of who you marry. Imagine being evicted because of who you are. Millions of Americans don't have to imagine this. They have to live it. Because in 31 states, it's legal to discriminate against LGBT people. Get the facts at beyondido.org. Brought to you by the Gill Foundation and the Ad Council.
Okay. Okay, Steve Behrman, I'm back with Peter B. Collins. Wish we had 2 hours. Interesting, you mentioned RT. I had a long conversation with Tom Hartman last summer, and he felt very comfortable when he moved to he moved to D.C. When Obama became president to have a TV show on RT. And after the 2016 election, he began to notice changes in their narrative that was much more pro-Trump. He also said that this was a tragic thing for Ed Schultz as well, and it possibly led to his broken heart, perhaps, that he felt that he couldn't leave there, even though he was seeing that something had changed. Another colleague of mine says that, who's done a lot of research on the media several years ago, he said that RT was the most reliable source, except when it involved issues involving Russia. Then it was not reliable, but in terms of everything else, it was. So, you know, it sounds like we have to vet very carefully where we get our information.
Steve, yeah. if I may, let me unload here a little bit, because
please unload.
RT should be treated skeptically. And when you see a report that is originating there or broadcast there, you should look at it critically and skeptically. You should do the same for anything that comes from Fox News, and you've got to redouble those efforts if you're watching MSNBC. That network has become a propaganda outlet of an anti-Trump operation. And let me just first let your listeners who don't know diddly about Peter B. Collins understand that I don't support Trump in any way. I think he is deeply corrupt. I think he has obstructed justice. And I think he has been impeachable since the very first day when he enjoyed the largest inaugural crowd in his own mind. And it's based on, you know, his business dealings, the emoluments clause, the hotel in Washington. And so this whole wild goose chase, I'm not calling it a hoax or a witch hunt, but the narrative that was generated that Russia meddled in the 2016 elections, that they hacked the DNC and gave it to WikiLeaks for the purpose of tilting the outcome to Trump, is something that is so far-fetched. And MSNBC has invested so much in its, you know, wall-to-wall coverage of the Mueller investigation. And as Mueller is preparing, we believe, to issue a report or a final report, we see that not a single person has been indicted for conspiracy with anybody, even with a Russian surname. Paul Manafort was convicted of crimes related to his own personal corruption, his tax evasion, his failure to register as a foreign agent, and some of the scams that he ran while he was in Ukraine. One of the fundamental falsehoods that's promoted is that Manafort was trying to tilt Ukraine and its corrupt leader, Yanukovych, toward Moscow, when in fact he was trying to carry out American foreign policy and tilt Ukraine toward NATO, the European Union, and the United States. And Manafort failed, but he made millions of dollars in the process. So what we are seeing here is an illusion that has been created and fed on a daily basis. And we come back to RT for a moment, because in the so-called intelligence assessment that was released on January 6th of 2017, there was 5 pages appended at the back in this kind of bizarre critique of RT, and they cited Abby Martin's program that had been canceled in 2014, where she challenged the credibility of American elections. And that's something that I've done for years, starting in 2000, without any help from any Russians, okay? The central claim that the online activities of the troll farm in St. Petersburg was working to sow division among Americans, I mean, what a crock, Steve. The biggest sower of division of Americans is a guy named Trump, who was given billions of dollars of free media exposure in 2016 to share his racist and nationalist messages with the audience that turned out and signed up to his Twitter account, and many of them actually voted for the guy. And so this whole derangement over the Russian meddling is something that I just find infuriating. And the liberals have all gone along with it because the Democratic Party endorses it. They see it as the way to explain Hillary's stunning loss. And I recognize that many people listening to me right now think that, wow, he's a crackpot. he doesn't believe Russiagate? All I can say is that I think many people are going to be deeply disappointed by whatever Mueller ultimately reports and what the new Attorney General Barr allows us to see from that report.
You know, it's very interesting that this has been, it's like we're fighting a two-front battle. On one hand, everybody, you know, many, many people recognize that Donald Trump is a criminal, et cetera, et cetera. And yet, to have it be just between these two, between these two elite powers, I'm just wondering, where is this third way going to come from? Where's the great upwising as we wake up and wise up? Where are the signs? I know that there are signs. Where do you see signs that people are waking up to move beyond these two very manufactured narratives? First, the Donald Trump manufactured narrative, which is easy for progressives to see through, and then this single-minded Russiagate designed to obfuscate the real reasons why Hillary lost. Say some more about that. Where do you see that the light of truth shining through?
I don't. The simple answer, I don't. And let me come back to Venezuela, all right? There is very little opposition to U.S.-backed regime change in Venezuela. There are a handful of Democrats, Ro Khanna, Tulsi Gabbard, Bernie Sanders, and Julian Castro. They have publicly said they don't support military intervention. Gabbard is the only one who is saying hands off. Almost everybody else just going along with the flow. And this is just another bad American regime change operation that will get us mired in a country for years to come. And it is driven by the oligarchs who want the oil.
Yep.
And it is just stunning to see such silence. And you know, the scene that I told you about, February 23rd at the bridge, the New York Times has exposed that as a fraud. Have you heard a single Democrat stand up and say, the Trump administration is trying to railroad us into Venezuela? No, they're trying to get first-class passage on that train ride.
You know, that's been the Democrats since you and I were born. That's been the Democrats, that they ultimately...
Look at how Ilhan Omar was smeared for things she never said as an anti-Semite. And initially, the Democrats created that resolution to essentially silence her. And they were shamed into turning it into a broad anti-hate resolution of all kinds. And now, you know, it's kind of meaningless, but the message was clear. That her statement that Israel has outsized influence over the U.S. Congress, they proved it. They proved it by going through those motions of attempting to silence her. And at the same time, Netanyahu is running for re-election in Israel, and Trump just deployed some U.S. troops to Israel for unknown reasons other than photo ops with Bibi Netanyahu. And there's no critical comment on that in the media. Netanyahu is articulating an anti-Arab racist thread of rhetoric that is just like Trump used in the midterm elections last fall. And when people want to silence Ilhan Omar and claim that she's anti-Semitic, they should at least have the moral compass to criticize the extremism of the Israeli government. But they don't.
And you see, I think this is really part of Trump's victory plan for 2020, which is, you know, make sure that he has his minions in place with their guns, and also make sure he has the support of AIPAC and Jewish people who will secretly vote for Donald Trump because they believe that he will safeguard Israel, i.e., the Netanyahu right-wing regime.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
It does, up to a point. I think that statistically, most American Jews vote Democratic, and I think many of them are wary of Trump's, moving the embassy to Jerusalem. And we're still waiting for Crown Prince Jared to present his Middle East peace plan, but it is expected to be a cram down where they unite Israel with some neighboring Arab countries and force the Palestinians to accept a really ugly deal. That's what I see on the horizon there. And the other piece is that Israel's number one goal is to get the United States to attack Iran for it.
That's right. And, Trump, and where does that seem to be heading?
Trump and Bolton seem to be not only willing but eager.
Yep.
And again,
yep.
There are some Democrats who oppose that, but it is undermined by AIPAC and its support for attacks on Iran.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And, you know, it's interesting. Of course, I've been I talk to all kinds of people. I've talked to people who, voted for Trump because he would they thought that he would dismantle the deep state. And as people like Bolton and Abrams get put on board, those people are, you know, even those who really, really, really would have wanted Trump to be the hero that he can never be, they're abandoning ship as well. And if you abandon ship, where do you go? What does it look like to you for 2020? What's the scenario for 2020?
At this point, I am open to this big field of Democratic candidates. I would like to see who can really come through the gauntlet here. And I think that Venezuela is an important test. I think that Iran is an important test. And most of the Democrats don't even address foreign policy in their campaign rhetoric. Bernie Sanders has been moving in that direction, and I applaud him for that. It was one of my biggest critiques of him in 2016. At this point, I still see Sanders as the one who has the greatest potential to defeat Trump because he has appealed beyond the membership ranks of the Democratic Party. Most of the centrist Democrats do not, and they kid themselves into thinking that a Hickenlooper who's pro-fracking and a very centrist corporate kind of Democrat can appeal to moderates. They kid themselves into thinking that Joe Biden has more miles on him. I'm sorry. It's over, Joe. And somebody's got to pull him aside and tell him. Of course, he thinks, Bernie and I are the same age. Why can't I run? But, Biden has so much political baggage from 36 years in the Senate and 8 years as Obama's vice president. So I at this point, I still think that Sanders has the greatest potential, but Trump is not easy to beat because he lies and lies and lies some more, and his base loves those lies, and they like being lied to. I mean, they support building the wall, and they've forgotten all about how Mexico was supposed to pay for it.
Exactly, exactly. And I think he's managed those people very, very well. And he's a champion demagogue, and people think he's honest because he tells the truth about lying. So in that regard, I guess he's more honest.
When he's calling Cohen a liar, it's like, come on.
Well, I think that you're right about the moderates, and that there is no such thing. You know, it's like it's like the traction that Jeb Bush got against Donald Trump. There isn't anybody there anymore, and the Democrats don't. At least the neoliberal branch doesn't understand that anymore. So, I agree. I think Bernie has earned the right. Plus, he has built a movement. Plus, he has the potential to address the economic issues that have been hurting people probably for, you know, for 40 years, but certainly for the last 10 years. And, you know, a lot of the progressive elites on the coast, they don't really get that. They don't really get how people across the land are suffering financially. And yeah. There's not a respite for that. Anything else before we sign off, Peter? This has been an extraordinary conversation.
Just that in August of 16, I placed a bet with Thomas Frank that Trump would win, and I had to collect on that bet. I regret it. But it was after visiting the Midwest and being exposed to exactly what you just described, Steve, the real hell that many Americans live in today.
Right, right. And also compounded by the disrespect that people feel coming from the mainstream media and the liberal elites. And I'm sure I read Thomas Frank's book. I could he should have gotten it. Anyway, this has been great. We've been speaking with Peter B. Collins, who's got his own podcast at peterbcollins.com. Tune in. He's a wise man and a wise guy. This is Steve Behrman, and I'll be with you next week on WikiPoliticky.
Thank you, Swami.
Okay.